Hello, and welcome back to Straw Planet Podcast. I'm your host, Jack Carr. So today I'm joined by Paul Bunker, who is joining us from Texas. So first of all, thank you, Paul, for joining me. And we start by telling us a little bit about your background and how it is that you got into dog handling and training.
Hi, Jack. Thanks for the invite and thanks for everyone tuning in and listening. Yeah, I was raised in the UK, although I now live in San Antonio, Texas, or just south of San Antonio, Texas. During my younger years, I would spend a lot of time on my father's farm, but he was away working. So, summer holidays and weekends, I would spend a lot of time on my own. And we had quite a few dogs at the time, pointer, border collie, Labradors. And I would walk the fields and hunt hedgerows and just be out with the dogs. So I was kind of raised with dogs part of growing up, and there was no other children in the area for me to have friends as such. So my friends were the dogs. When I left school, I left early with no real exams and decided that, dogs was the way I wanted to go forward. I mean, it was just a natural progression from what I'd been doing. But the only way you could do that back in the UK then was to join the police or the military. And I was actually too short for the police by 2 inches. So I joined the military, I joined the army. And I'm glad I did. It was as a dog trainer. So I spent the first 6 years, 6 months of my career doing infantry training, become a soldier. And then I joined the Royal Army Veterinary Corps as a dog trainer. And you then had to go through an extensive training period. So I did 2 weeks to become an attack dog handler, if you want to call it that, protection dog handler, as we termed it. And then I think it was up to 3 months doing equitation, learning how to ride a horse, and then a month becoming a veterinary or learning the basics of veterinary technician work, how to care for your dog. And then the actual dog training exam was 3 months long. So I completed that. So it's over a year even to get into the corps. Realized very quickly that I loved working with dogs, got to travel the world, and was put on some special projects, which allowed me to develop new training techniques and protocols, which again I loved. And that started to investigate or instigate my passion into this entering fields and projects where there's no known template and actually developing dogs and developing protocols and integrating them into the field. I served 22 years in the British Army, and the last couple of years I was actually training United States military for a program they wanted to set up with canines. And when I retired, they asked me to come over, set up the program in the United States, which I did. I did off-leash detection, special projects, and then tracking dogs. And I actually ended up program manager for research and development in detection for the Office of Naval Research. And that got me more into that academic side of dog training and understanding more about what dogs are capable of doing. I was promoted to director of the school, which I really did not fit into that position personally because it was dealing with humans and away from dogs. And I was fortunate that I managed to secure a project in Canada for 4 months with four dog teams, including myself handling a dog, looking for spilled oil. And, that reignited my passion for being in the field with dogs because 6 days a week for 4 months, we was in the field. We were encountering bear and moose and beaver every day, but also finding all this spilled oil, which was buried, sequestered under the water or under sand or in racks of vegetation, and being really successful. And by the end of that, the teams altogether had found over 8,000 samples of oil, which had been washed up from this spill. And returning to the US from Canada, I realized, well, that's my passion. That's what I want to do. And I resigned from the company and started Chiron K9 in 2017. And the focus was always going to be detection because I love detection of with dogs, but also I wanted to steer the company towards conservation environmental work. And that's predominantly what I do now. So 50% of my work would be supporting research in detection through academic research, training the dogs for academics, or hosting research or actually conducting research. 40% is still working in the field, which I absolutely love. I have a Springer Spaniel and a Labrador. And then about 10% I spend giving seminars, advanced training to law enforcement units and those sort of things, workshops, to pass back some education. So it's brought us to a place now where I think it's about 7 years since I started my company, that the focus really is everything that I found I enjoyed decades ago in the military, which is developing these special projects, supporting conservation and environmental work, and actually challenging my capability as a dog trainer.
Brilliant. And what are some of these unique advantages that dogs offer within the field of conservation? You touched on the oil detection there. What are some of the other projects that you've been involved with?
I've been involved personally in a variety of projects. Iguana detection down in the British Virgin Islands on Anegada. The iguana there is critically endangered because of predation. And every year, a team goes down from Fort Worth Zoo, but local citizen scientists as well are involved in trying to protect the nests once the iguana's dug its chamber out and laid the nest. And then they band it if they can locate the nest with metal. And once the hatchlings hatch, the nests are checked twice a day. Those hatchlings are gathered, taken to a first art facility on the island, which allows them to be captive raised until they're 2 years old. And about that age, they're big enough not to be predated on. It's mostly by cats. And they're released again. And then later in the season, the team go out again and they're looking for any hatchlings that haven't been scooped up in the nest, because the nests are very difficult to find. So Kelly Bradley, the biologist of Fort Worth Zoo, goes down there twice a year. She'd asked, could canines assist in that project? So I trained a canine for her to detect iguana nests and hatchlings. And Pena has been very successful down there. I've also been involved in Wyoming toad, which only exists in one county in the world and is critically endangered. You know, there's a broad spectrum within the United States, but also I've been fortunate to be involved with Working Dogs Conservation and the Saular Foundation in training a couple of dogs for them to be used in Laos, People's Democratic Republic of Laos in Asia, hunting for what is believed to be the most critically endangered mammal in the world. So, you know, the whole spectrum there is broad. And every month I'm out in the field actually working my dogs or assisting other people to try and develop programs or developing programs myself. And we're going to actually get 6 dogs in 2 weeks and start our next program.
And which types of dogs are best for the roles of detection?
You know, it's more about traits. So you need a dog that you can utilize their desire to work, if you like. So typically, the way I train is by using reinforcement, and that'd be food or toys. And I just firstly need a dog that has a desire to either play with its toy or eat food or both or treats. And that allows us to tap into that desire and actually pair it with an odor and then teach them what we want to teach. Now, there's also other things. The dogs must be social. They must be environmentally sound. We don't need dogs necessarily that will chase wildlife. They need to be a size which is suitable for the terrain. So in Laos, we use spaniels because it's very thick forest type terrain with bamboo and a lot of overgrowth. So spaniels can get in there and hunt off leash very effectively. Mostly I'll use hunt type dogs, so pointers, spaniels, labradors, but really any dog, even mixed breed dogs, can be used as long as they have the right characteristics to suit the job that you're looking for. And one of the first things I do when I'm looking at a conservation project and the client says, you know, here's my statement of work, is try and work out what breed of dog innately holds the characteristics that would suit their job, because that's going to make my life a lot easier. And also when the dog's deployed into the field, it actually suits that type of environment and that type of job, rather than just, well, I like this breed, so I'm going to choose it.
Okay. And just to pick that apart a little bit further, which, again, it's probably quite a broad question, which types of breeds fit which types of climate?
Climate generally is more adaptable by dogs that have been born into that and live in that environment. And it's not just climate, it's because of local diseases that the dogs can become not immune to, but certainly resilient to. But sometimes, like the dogs in Laos, there isn't the type of dogs we need to do this type of detection work within the local community. So we had to import spaniels for that project. And you know, there has been challenges. The dogs have had to deal with some of the local issues, diseases, and we've had to actually have advanced protocols to assist with that because they wasn't raised in that type of environment. They're not as immune to those type of things. So you know, one particular dog would not necessarily suit one particular role, but you're always looking at these innate traits that the dogs hold. You know, and for decades now, or well, a couple of centuries, humans have been breeding dogs for work. Now, they've been purpose breeding dogs for many centuries. You know, the Chinese bred small dogs to fit in wealthy ladies' arms. The pharaohs, we know, they had a greyhound type dog. You know, very early on in our integration of dogs into our families, humans were starting to mess with breeding. But it's in the last century or so that we've started breeding for work. And you have things like the German Shepherd, the Malinois, Labrador, Springer Spaniel. These types of dogs have started to be specifically bred for certain roles, but a lot of these roles suit conservation as well.
I heard you mention a couple of times, maybe it's a little bit of bias, but do you think are spaniels particularly good for this type of work?
Yeah, you know, I have a personal spaniel. She was actually gifted to me, but I love her. She's an amazing working dog. I've trained some spaniels for projects. For certain projects, yes, and for certain people. I mean, spaniels are not necessarily working spaniels with very high drive are not necessarily the easiest dogs to live with because they're constantly on the go. They constantly need that activity. They need their brain challenge. So my dog, Poppy, if I don't work her every day or have her do something every day, then she's wired, you know, and she's all over the house. She just won't stop. They're an excellent breed, but they have their limitations like any other breed. You know, if you're looking for a more calm, balanced dog, then a Labrador is probably something that's more suitable. If you're looking for something which is larger, which has good hunt capability, but not as high drivey, then a lot of the pointers kind of suit that. So again, we go back to that individual characteristics within a breed, but then even within a breed, each dog can have its own character, which comes out in its training.
Brilliant. And in terms of scale, how widely is your work being adopted? Are you sort of more, is it just Huron Canine? Are you guys sort of pioneers in this sort of work? Is it been quite, used quite broadly worldwide? What's the general sense of, as I say, how widely these practices and dogs are being put into work for these projects?
Yeah, so as a community, conservation canines are growing. And I think it's fair to say it's probably the fastest growing utilization of working dogs in the world because people are starting to really realize what contribution they make to their conservation effort, whether that's ecologists and biologists wanting support of dogs or bringing in their own dogs to their projects, or it's anti-poaching in Africa, for instance. You know, it's constantly growing all the time. And really, the limitation at the minute is just people's understanding and education of how dogs could integrate and be an effective, I'll say tool. You know, we don't want to say the dog is a tool, but an effective enhancement of their field work that really does assist in being productive in actually locating their targets. Because you know, I work with detection dogs myself, but there are obviously tracking dogs that look for poachers. So it is growing rapidly. I purposely keep my company very small. It's just myself and my training partner, Christina. I don't have services. I don't employ dog handlers because I always wanted to focus on projects and education, seminars, workshops, as I said, supporting academia, and enhancing the whole capability within the community. There are other organizations that supply dogs, dog teams, and support projects on a lot bigger scale. And then actually, 2 days ago, I was in Washington, D.C. The Wildlife Society had their first inaugural Conservation Canine Working Group symposium, where people came from all over the world, including Australia, to present for the day about different projects and different aspects of conservation dogs. We've also formed the Canine Dog Alliance, which again starts to bring all these people together under one umbrella organization, which is there for education and support to allow people to understand how either they can integrate these canines into their projects, or if they want to start to get involved themselves with canines, how to go about getting education and training to allow them to do that. So it's growing, you know, and it's growing all the time. And it's the limitation is human imagination.
Brilliant. Oh, good to hear. And you touched on, well, you mentioned there some of your, we alluded to your academic work. Would you mind sort of highlighting some of the key innovations and techniques that you've implemented, and perhaps in reference to these wonderful contraptions that you've got pictured behind you?
Yeah, so I this is my training lab in South Texas. The lab is used obviously to conduct research predominantly, although we do some basic training inside, and then before we move the dogs outside. Behind me is a carousel. This is an odor carousel. I imported this from the UK. It was purpose made. These are made of stainless steel, medical grade stainless steel, and the idea for these initially was for medical detection dogs, dogs that look for cancer or other diseases in humans, but I use it for conservation work. We can put odor in these pots that you can see here. There are lids on top with little holes in, and we can work the dog, and then the carousel spins, and I can work the dog again. That means I don't have to keep setting up training scenarios and the actual odor moves all the time. There's 12 pots in this, and I can put different odors in different pots. So the dog might be smelling hot dog, tennis ball, and then its target. Also, we can run this blind in that the assistant sets it up, spins it. I don't know where the target is. The dog doesn't know where the target is, and we search for it. Behind me, this is called an olfactometer. This is a computer-driven, there's a computer there, device, which it presents odor in these three ports, and the computer decides which odor is going to be presented. It could be target, which we've placed inside, or it could be any one of five distractors. So distractors again could be any smell we want to place in there, and the dog has to identify which port has its odor in. And if it responds, in our case, it's just hold its nose in the port for over 4 seconds. The computer tells it it's correct, and we give it its reward. We use this in academic research. It is based in the cloud so that the university can actually look at real-time results when we're doing research and detection capabilities. It's a hugely powerful device in that it does so many different things for canine olfaction that it would take an hour just on its own to describe everything it does. Dr. Nathan Hall and his team at Texas Tech, they actually built this for me. And I support a lot of their research using this device. And as I said, it is wired into the cloud at Texas Tech. So he can look at those results, but also all the results are recorded, even down to temperature of the room at the time, how long the dog sniffed a particular paw, everything. So this is a great research device. And then to this side, these are stands, odor stands. There's a series of these stands along the wall, again from the UK. These hold sample vials. They were developed again for medical research dogs, but I use these in different research projects. So not only do we conduct research here, I support research at university locations. So Texas Tech, the Canine Olfaction Lab is one of the big ones that I support a lot with Dr. Nathan Horland's team. They do a lot of olfaction research. Texas A&M University down in Corpus Christi. Every month we go down there and we do surveys of the beach for spilled and historic oil leaks. I've supported Dr. DeGrief and her team at Florida International University looking at fractions of oil and different ways that dogs can detect different types of odor. As I said, I've just returned from Canada doing a project with United States Coast Guard, researching capabilities of dogs looking for oil spills underwater and under ice. Or we're going to look at under ice in January. So there's a lot of research going on. And it's not just, you know, with myself. Dr. Hall's lab, for instance, looks at lanternfly and has set up a citizen science program teaching people how to look for the lanternfly within the United States, which is a huge invasive pest issue. We've looked at invasive muscle vellingers with Dr. Hall and his team, and now that's being deployed by Muscle Dogs. The company is called Muscle Dogs in the US, screening boats for invasive mussels as they move from lake to lake. So, you know, there's a lot of academic research going on, and I'm only part of that, but I do offer this unique niche in that I support this sophisticated research, and my research is obviously focused on conservation and environmental work.
Brilliant. And we've covered my next couple of questions quite comprehensively. So, of course, you're very much at the forefront and at the forefront of research and these initiatives and things. How do you see things or the field more generally evolving over the coming years?
Yeah, so I've been training professionally for over 40 years. I know I don't look that old, but I have been in this game over 40 years. And I now more recently in the last 5, 6 years, I've been integrated into part of this academic research through Texas Tech University, Texas A&M, Florida International, and the likes. And really, it still amazes me how good dogs are. And I thought I'd seen everything when it came to dog training, but they amaze us all the time. And the research is really pushing the boundaries on what we're capable to do. Not only the research, but our understanding of how dogs learn and how to train dogs. When I started training dogs way back when, we didn't use food and we didn't use toys. It was just praise. We had a flat collar on the dog, and that was it. Nowadays, we understand animal learning. We use a clicker, which is a little metal box. It makes a sound, and we pair it with a reward. So we're able to tap in to the psychological side of dog training and actually push the boundaries now of our understanding of what dogs can do. So the actual challenges, again, is not in the dog's capability, it's in our imagination. A couple of weeks ago, as I said, I was in Canada. My dog was on the front of a boat looking for spilled oil in a lake. This is the first time in the world that we know of that any dog has done this, and she was very successful. Now, that's again something where even nowadays we're pushing the boundaries and proving things that dogs are capable to do, which we had no idea really how good they were until we tried it, till we researched it and actually pushed the boat out, if you pardon
So
the
to
pun.
speak.
But, outside of dogs being used on the front of boats looking for spills, then you've got to deploy divers or underwater drones or, this very advanced technology, which is great, but they have limitations, just as dogs do. But together, the complement is that dogs could scan a massive lake very quickly and say, this is a priority area. This is a priority area. Cut the area very small down into where you need to investigate, and then put your divers in, or then put your drone in, which are obviously limited resources and expensive and take time. So working together, integrating dogs now into the field in a team type environment means that the whole project can be a lot more successful.
Wonderful. Where can people find you to get involved or find out more about or support your work?
My website is Chiron, Chiron dash K the number 9.com. And I'm also on Instagram. I post a lot of the projects and what I do on Instagram. As I said, I don't employ handlers or anything, but certainly, when I hear about things, if people ask me, I'll pass it along. The Conservation Dog Alliance, CDA, conservationdogalliance.org. They're a great organization. We've just started. I'm one of the founding members. And they offer a lot of education every month, free webinars, free skill learns, where people can actually learn about different projects and how to get involved. And also, Kayla Fratt of Canine Conservationists, who's one of the founding members of that, she runs an online dog handler course, which teaches all the theoretical aspects. And we're hoping to develop a practical course as well. So it's starting to open these doors to allow people that don't have any experience at the minute, want to get involved, to actually start to have some sort of pathway of training so they can become involved. Outside of that, I'm always available to discuss projects, support academics, support biologists and ecologists in developing programs to suit themselves. And with a lot of the work that I do and others, we have to innovate whole new techniques and protocols to actually support the projects to allow the dogs to actually understand how to support the type of work we're looking for. Like the iguana detection, I had to invent two whole new devices to train dogs to look for iguana nests under the sand and look for hatchlings. But the dog has been successful and actually found nests and hatchlings. In fact, I went to an agata, imprinted the dog with a hatchling on this new device I'd invented, took her out in the field that day, and she found her first hatchling on the first day, and she's found hatchling since. And on the nests, I actually trained her in Texas on nests, went to the island, and on the first deployment, we found a nest tunnel, the entrance to a nest, which is refilled with sand, so it wasn't visible. So, we as we're starting to understand odor, the dynamics of odor, how dogs learn, how they smell, olfaction, everything else, we're starting to really push that boundary, as I keep saying, and able to support biologists, ecologists, and others in support. So if someone has a question about that, more than happy to answer that, they can reach out.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jack.